The Sports Illustrated Media Podcast is brought to you by Harry's Razors. Superior razors shipped straight to your door at half the drugstore price. Get $5 off your first order by using the code SIMedia at harrys.com. This podcast is also sponsored by FanDuel. Now that baseball's back, you can try the fun and competition of Daily Fantasy risk-free for up to $10. Go to FanDuel.com and enter the code SIMedia.
I hope in the end that mothers are the ones who are reading this book. If mothers read this and start taking more active roles in their kids' baseball careers and keeping them healthy, then I think the book has had its true intended impact.
Horses in the wild do it all the time. Thoroughbreds, there's this weird rule, like you have to do it the old-fashioned way. Other sports you can artificially inseminate. And these are million-dollar animals doing a 15-second act where four people sort of choreographing it.
Welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, where each week we interview a member of the sports media. I'm your host, Richard Deitch. My producer is Bette Marston. And this week, we have two guests. Both are working sports writers as well as authors. And so this is going to be a little bit different, this podcast. We'll get into a little bit of how one writes a book while also working full-time in the sports media. Our guests this week are the Yahoo MLB columnist Jeff Passan, whose new book is The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Later on, we'll talk to Joe Drape, the award-winning sports writer for the New York Times, who specializes in horse racing and investigations. He has a new book out later this month titled American Pharaoh, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise. So Jeff Passan and Joe Drape on this podcast. Thank you very much for listening to the previous podcast from Ken Burns, who has the great Jackie Robinson film on PBS, to Hubie Brown, to Renee Young of the WWE, Carol Lawson, the fine ESPN basketball analyst. Coming up in a couple of weeks, we'll have Jessica Mendoza, the ESPN MLB analyst, and many others. All right, well, we will first start this podcast with Jeff Passan, the Yahoo Major League Baseball columnist, whose new book is out now called The Arm. All right, and as promised, we bring in Jeff Passan, the Yahoo Major League Baseball columnist, as well as why he's here, his new book called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Jeff, welcome to the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Hope you're doing well.
Jeff, why did you write this book?
It was all trying to answer a simple question, which was why does Major League Baseball spend $1.5 billion every year on something it does not understand? And, when I really looked into the pitching arm and tried to see where baseball's knowledge was, I found that it was really rudimentary and that teams were going out and giving giant signing bonuses and signing enormous contracts with guys who they were simply taking guesses on. And for a sport as rooted in efficiency as baseball likes to believe it is, to go out and spend almost half of your money every year on something you really don't understand very well did not seem to be the peak of efficiency to me. So I felt like it was a story that needed exploring and understanding and trying to figure out how it got to this point.
Jeff, there's always usually a moment in the process of ultimately deciding to do a book where you believe that this will be a good topic to explore, or you discover something in the midst of your reporting and you file it away, like this would be a really good idea. When did the conception of this happen? Was it just on the course of the beat for you talking to pitchers and being interested in this, or did someone trigger a light in you and that's when this idea came to the fore?
It happened at 3 o'clock in the morning in May of 2012 when my son was 1 month old and I was up with him in the middle of the night. And I have no idea why I started thinking about pitching then. Maybe it's a window into my creepy mind. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I had talked with Dan Duquette, the Orioles general manager, about how he was handling Dylan Bundy, a kid who they gave $6 million out of high school. And I was talking with Alex Anthopoulos about Noah Syndergaard and Aaron Sanchez and Justin Nicolino, you know, three young arms they were limiting innings-wise in the Toronto Blue Jays organization. And neither of them seemed to have good reasons for putting these innings limits on players. And I just thought, you know, if this is their answer, and Dan Duquette and Alex Anthopoulos are both bright guys, and they're both guys who really try to think through problems. If this is what they're doing, what's it like around the rest of baseball? And so, you know, my mind starts racing in the middle of the night, and I don't know when I wake up the next morning whether I'm going to think I'm a moron for having spent like 20 or 30 minutes thinking this through and conceiving chapters in my head, or whether it actually was a good idea. And when I wrote it down the next morning, I'm like, this is not a story. I think this is a book.
Jeff, what was the process of putting together a proposal? I'm not sure people who are listening know just sort of how what a sort of an arduous world that can be, and you want to write a great proposal because ultimately the proposal sells the book more than anything else. So how did you approach that? How long did that take?
I approached it. The word I will use is methodically. I think other people would use the word procrastinating. It took me a long time to do the proposal. And this was for two reasons. Number one, really part of this book that was the most important, thing, I think, was getting consent from at least one big league pitcher to sit in on his Tommy John surgery and then follow him for the next year coming back. That was going to be the narrative arc of the story, following this guy through his ups and downs and telling the story of the arm through him. And it turns out I got two pitchers, Daniel Hudson with the Diamondbacks and Todd Coffey, who at the time was with the Dodgers. And, you know, I got to sit in on Coffey's surgery and follow Hudson. And I wanted the proposal to be done at about the 1 year mark, because this was, you know, a lot of authors will want to get it done before they do any reporting, but this was the first book I've done by myself. And it was an abstract enough concept where I felt like if I didn't have a lot of really substantive information and a couple of good sample chapters, that it might be a tough sell. And so I really wanted to lock it down. Well, Daniel Hudson blows his arm out again at 11 months, and Todd Coffey still is not back at 18 months like he wanted to. And so it just keeps getting stretched out and stretched out, and the story is going longer and longer than I expected. And at some point I said, I just have to sell this thing to make sure that, you know, I haven't been doing 2 years of work for naught. And ultimately, I put the proposal together at the right time, because I did have two great sample chapters. You know, I had Coffey's surgery from inside the operating room, and I was there the night Hudson blew out for the second time, and spent the whole night with him for that while he was sitting there nervous that he had torn his elbow again after 11 months of recovery, which was an arduous enough process as it was. So once those two things were in place, you know, you have to do everything from writing the sample chapters to outlining what your other chapters are going to look like, to defining the market and who you think this reaches and affects. And it's really a very complicated thing to try and sell publishers that you're going to be doing a great work. I mean, there's a lot involved, and I'm just glad that that the 2 years were not for naught.
Jeff, one of the first chapter of the book is set in the operating room of, as you mentioned, of Todd Coffey. And it's pretty fascinating reading in terms of what that surgery is like. You're a reporter in a room with medical people. You obviously had to get permission, I would imagine, from the subject to be in there. What was the process like? I mean, the chapter is so detailed that I imagine and I think maybe you even write this, that the surgery was filmed. Like you, I'm just curious, how does one take notes and how does one become observant? You're not a medical doctor. You didn't go to medical school. So these are terminology that might be foreign to you. So what was your process in reporting being in the middle of an operation?
I was very lucky because Stan Conte, the former trainer of the Dodgers, he's running his own consulting firm right now, and a very media-friendly among medical personnel, he's about as media-friendly as it gets. And he was right there. And when Neil Eletrosh, the surgeon, was doing something, I would, in very hushed tones, say to Stan, okay, what's going on right now? And Stan would more or less walk me through it. And you want to be as much of a fly on the wall as possible in that situation. But, there was a point where Todd Coffey did not have any tendons left in his body that they could use to make him a new ulnar collateral ligament. And so they had to bring in a baggie with a cadaverous tendon. And it's something as simple as, okay, walking over and looking at the details on the baggie. And does it say the age of the patient or what the donor number is or any of those little details that I think make the, make the chapter richer. Afterward, when I was done, I was frightened at the idea that I had screwed up the medical stuff. So I read portions of the chapter to multiple orthopedic surgeons to make sure that my terminology was correct and that what I had witnessed was something that they have been familiar with and seen throughout their careers as well. And at that point, my lack of a medical degree, I'm compensating for that by bringing in people who not only have a medical degree, but who can tell me, okay, this is good, this is bad, this is what it needs to say.
Jeff, what is the process of getting Sandy Koufax to agree to an interview?
It started off with me, I was told that I should mail him a letter. And so I mailed him a letter to a P.O. box in Vero Beach, Florida, that promptly got returned to sender because apparently he did not own the P.O. box anymore. Then it was probably every 6 months, I think, I would bug Joe Jarek with the Dodgers and say, Koufax ready to talk, Koufax ready to talk. And I knew the answer was no the whole time. I understood that it wasn't going to happen. And that was, that was my white whale. And I would just have to live with not having Sandy Koufax in this book. And then in, I believe, March of 2014, I got an email from Steve Brenner with the Dodgers saying, would you like to talk with Sandy Koufax tomorrow? And I was like, yes, I most certainly would. And so I booked a plane ticket and hauled ass out to Phoenix and got a half hour with him. And it was probably the worst interview of my life because I was just so nervous and intimidated because it's Sandy Koufax. And like all the questions that I could, like I could have talked with him for 10 hours and having to pare it down to 30 minutes. I was like Chris Farley on the Chris Farley show, just sitting there like, hey, Mr. Koufax, how are you, man? I mean, it was kind of embarrassing in hindsight, but I only later found out that the reason he agreed to talk with me is because the wonderful Jane Levy told him that he should. And she, she did not talk with him for her biography on him, but she has a good relationship with him, and God bless her, she helped set that up.
So, and I know she, I think she was one of the readers of your book before it was published. So she reached out She reached out to Koufax for you, and that's how it worked.
She did. Yeah, that is. It was as good of a solid as you can possibly imagine.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's just pure luck right there. I don't know what I did to deserve that, but I am forever indebted to Jane for that and many, many other kindnesses.
How did you multitask during the writing and researching of the book with your day-to-day job, which obviously is writing baseball for Yahoo?
What's the word I'm looking for here? With great difficulty. and with far less sleep than I needed. And it's not just those two things. It's maintaining a healthy marriage and being a good father. And honestly, all the other things that people today have to deal with. Like I didn't feel like it was terribly unique. Yahoo was extremely gracious in allowing me to do this while maintaining my day job. And honestly, it's probably not something I would do again, just because it is a lot of work. It's like two full-time jobs at once and two demanding jobs. But when I needed time, Yahoo gave it to me. I'd say about half of this book was written in like a 10-day period, where I went out to Phoenix to my parents' house just to get away from the noise of a household with two young boys, and sat down and just started writing. And pretty much for 10 straight days wrote and plowed through about 60,000 words.
Jeff, this is very much an inside media question, but when you are writing a book but are working full-time for an organization, does that organization want you to give them parts of that book first before you excerpt it anywhere else? Meaning, is it part of either your contract or just something that you believe you should do to give Yahoo the first rights to maybe publish something before it goes out and gets published elsewhere?
I mean, there's a conflict there, and you know, it's your day job and the people who pay you versus what is best for the book. And I'll be honest, like it's a tough question to answer, because the Sports Illustrated was running an excerpt and Yahoo wanted the excerpt first, and I fully and completely understand that. They gave me the time away to go and do this, and I think that's something that if your employer is doing that, you know, you owe them the courtesy of that. And at first it didn't occur to me that that was the case. And that was a selfish thing for me to think. And I was thinking of the book first, but I snapped to eventually and understood that Yahoo's done me a great service in allowing me to do this. And I also think that the book is good for everyone involved. I mean, the feedback on this has been great from inside the baseball world and outside both. And I'd like to think that hopefully Yahoo's reputation too is bolstered by something like this. I mean, it's not like Yahoo's reputation frankly needs bolstering. I mean, we've got the best columnist in America and Dan Wetzel. We've got the best basketball writer and Adrian Wojnarowski. We've got the best college writer and Pat Forty. We've got Charles Robinson, who's among the best football writers. I mean, Tim Brown is the wordsmith of wordsmiths on baseball. And I'm, you know, passing people like Eric Adelson and Jay Busby and Kevin Ioli. And I mean, our staff is incredibly good. But something like this, I feel like it was the same thing with Death of the BCS, that when that book came out, it was associated with Yahoo. And I think that book did a lot of good, and I'm hoping that this one does the same.
Jeff, who is the most surprising person within baseball that you've heard from about this book so far?
Oh, boy. I think a couple general managers who have read it already and just sort of plowed through it in like 24 hours. And I don't want to name names, but they've said this is the book that needed to be written. And that is very flattering to hear. And it's also people outside of baseball, to be honest. I mean, I hope in the end that mothers are the ones who are reading this book. Like baseball fans, I just sort of expect to read it because I think they love good baseball books. And I think baseball is a sport that more than anything is perfect for the book medium. But if mothers read this and start taking more active roles in their kids' baseball careers and keeping them healthy, then I think the book has had its true intended impact. Whereas it started off as this idea that I'm going to look into what the major leagues are like. The more I looked into the youth space, the more I think it evolved into that.
Jeff, what have you learned about the publicity process regarding selling a book? You know, one of the obviously things they don't teach you when you're, you're in the process of reporting and writing. There's a whole marketing and public relations component of selling books, and maybe that's even the most important part of the book in the end. So what have you learned about publicity in the midst of promoting your first solo book here?
I don't understand it and don't understand how it works and don't understand why some people choose to talk about the book or why some people don't. Like, I thought that this was a tailor-made book for like a morning TV show whose entire audience is parents. And we did not get a single sniff there. And yet Fresh Air, which I think is probably like among the most intelligent shows of any medium, certainly, we talked for an hour and a half and they gave me a 20-minute segment. And On Point, an NPR out of Boston, did a full hour on it. And the New York Times had me write an op-ed. I mean, they're, you know, just seeing which publications are interested in it is fascinating. And I wish I better understood why certain mediums are on it and why certain ones are not, but I still don't get it, man. It's really confusing to me. And maybe this changes, you know, maybe a month from now, as baseball kicks into gear, it'll be a little bit different. But for right now, that part is certainly the confusing.
All right, a couple more here with Jeff Passan. Jeff, what did you learn from this book writing, research, reporting experience that will help whatever your next book is, will help make your next book easier or streamline the process? I think, you know, there are young people who are listening to this who want to ultimately write a book. A lot of people obviously are interested in sports, probably listening to this podcast. So what are some of the things you learned from this process that you think will help you in your next book?
First and foremost, that I can do it. Like, that was my big thing coming into this. You know, you have this great idea and you have the cooperation of the necessary people. And sometimes you sit there and you're staring at your screen and you say, am I really going to finish this? Can I really do this? And if I do this, is it just going to be a flaming pile of crap or is it going to be something that's good? And so in the end, I think I was pretty happy with it. And that's, you know, that gives you confidence going into the next one. Ultimately, it's about organization. And I was very lucky. I went to the University of Kansas, found a couple of great journalism students named Mike Vernon and Blake Schuster, and they pretty much transcribed every word that was on tape. And that was in exchange for beer money. And it was the best money that I have ever spent, because if I had to transcribe all of the tape for this book, it never would have gotten done. And so it's about prioritizing time and it's about organization. And I think I'll be much more confident whenever the next book comes going into that.
All right, we'll finish up with a couple of quick baseball things. What's the most interesting story that you've seen so far in 2016?
I think the only story of 2016 is the Chicago Cubs and whether they win or lose, because the Red Sox are not all that interesting. The Yankees are not all that interesting. And the Cubs are the best team, at least have the best talent in baseball. You can argue that even without Kyle Schwarber. And so while that is a devastating injury for them, it's not the sort of thing that's going to derail their season. And I think all eyes are on the Cubs from now until October.
Jeff, tell me why I'm incorrect that the Toronto Blue Jays, in my opinion, are going to be playing in the World Series this year.
I don't necessarily think you're incorrect, but I'd argue that the Houston Astros have every bit as much talent as them. And if they can figure out how to get their bullpen together after a mess of a first week, that they are younger, likelier to stay healthy, and they have more in the tank as far as minor league call-ups go.
Jeff, who would be of interest to people and would be of surprise to people who are really good interviews in Major League Baseball? You know, I think people know that, like, it's fun to talk to guys like David Ortiz, et cetera. But, you know, you're a national columnist, so you deal with all the teams. Name some guys who I think people would just be surprised that, you know, these are really thoughtful, interesting interviews.
I think Sean Doolittle is certainly one of those guys. You know, educated guy, went to the University of Virginia, thoughtful guy, conscientious guy. His girlfriend, Erin Dolan, is pretty hilarious, too. And so he's definitely high up on the list. I love talking with Joe Mauer, actually. And maybe it's because he comes to Kansas City three times a year, and I've gotten to know him throughout the years, but he's just a, like you see him, and he's just a very nice, quiet, lacking ego human being. And that's one of those where I think if you asked other reporters, what do you think of Joe Mauer? They'd say, God, he's boring as paint drying. But I think he's spectacular. And Jose Bautista, I think, is, when you get Jose Bautista talking and being truly candid, I'm not sure there's anybody in baseball who is more insightful and interesting and thoughtful. And he has, listen, he has his tendencies to go off and to rant, but ultimately I think he is a boon to the game. And every time the Blue Jays are in town, I love talking with him.
All right, final two, Jeff. If you were the commissioner of baseball, what would you do to make the game more appealing to young people?
Oh, man. That's such a tough question. I think speeding it up certainly does help. I don't know how to apply this, but taking advantage of the technology that you have. MLBAM is an absolute force, and what they've been able to do, not just outside of the baseball space, but with the at-bat app, with MLB Network, and with all of the things that go along with it, I think is incredible. And you have to translate that into younger fans somehow, because you cannot survive with the average age of your baseball fan being a 55-year-old white male. Just can't do it.
And then finally, Jeff, I'm going to make you I'm going to give you sort of this ultimate power where I will allow you to put two people in the Baseball Hall of Fame that are currently not in the Baseball Hall of Fame. Who would you choose and why?
Barry Bonds and Roger Clemens, because they were the best players of their era. And I don't think the Hall of Fame should be a referendum on morality. I think it's a place where you put the best players and their plaques say exactly what happened with them. And let fans, let parents, let children, let everyone judge them how they may. But the Hall of Fame is the place for the best players, not the best players who hew to a moral standard by a handpicked group of people whose morality, frankly, is not necessarily clean themselves. And I'm not saying the Baseball Writers Association is full of amoral sinners, so to speak, but for them to sit here and play God on all of the players who they're excluding because of something that, frankly, we don't know as much about as we should in performance-enhancing drugs. I'm just not down with that.
Are you a voter, Jeff?
I am a voter.
Okay. Our guest is, or has been, the Yahoo MLB columnist Jeff Passan. He has a book I highly recommend out. It is called The Arm, Inside the Billion-Dollar Mystery of the Most Valuable Commodity in Sports. Check it out. Jeff, I know that this was nowhere near the honor of being on Fresh Air. Still.
Listen.
Nor, by the way, will it be close in the number of people listening.
You are the Terry Gross of the SI Media podcast.
Right. Yeah, I've been trying to think of maybe the Terry O'Reilly or something, but not the Terry Gross. All right, Jeff Passan has been the guest. You could actually, you can also check out his work on Yahoo, obviously, fine baseball writer. Jeff, wish you best of luck with the book. It's a really interesting read. I have no doubt it'll do well. And thank you very much for being on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Richard. Appreciate it.
All right, spring is here, and whether you're catching a game, relaxing at the beach, or just going to work, it's time to ditch the winter scruff and feel the sun on your face with a smooth shave from Harry's Razors. With Harry's, not only do you get a close, comfortable shave, you get high-quality German-engineered blades for half the price you're used to. Men know what a pain it is to shave, to buy razors. So in this case, Harry's is fantastic. Razors, you know, cost a lot of money. That's why the Patriots play in that beautiful stadium named after them. And so we know here at Sports Illustrated that both Ben Eagle and Dan Bloom are big users of Harry's razors. When they want, those two are very clean-shaven and look very good. Harry's gives you direct, or I should say Harry's gives you factory direct prices. They cut out the middleman and ship their products right to your door. Harry's starter set is the best option for new customers and a great deal. For just $15, you get a razor handle, shaving cream, and three of Harry's five-blade German-engineered razors. Plus, for listeners of this show, Harry's is giving you $5 off your first purchase by using the promo code SIMedia. Go to harrys.com right now. That's harrys.com. And make sure you use our code SIMedia at the checkout to let them know who sent you. Okay, and as promised, Joe Drape of the New York Times specializes in horse racing investigations, and he has a new book coming out later this month titled American Pharaoh, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise. Joe Drape, thank you very much for joining us on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Richard, I really appreciate you having me. How are you today?
I'm good. Joe, why did you write this book?
Let's call it an exorcism of 20 years of reporting on horse racing and about 40 years of just liking the sport. I've sat out there for seven almost triple crowns coming into this year, and every time we got two out of three, publishers would circle and say, you know, would you be interested? And I, of course, I was always going to be interested, but this was the first year nobody actually came and said anything about that. And I sat there, and I watched this horse came in, and it just occurred to me that I had to get this out of my system. I've covered the highs, the lows, the good feel-good stories and the terrible stories, and this was just an interesting bunch. You had an iconic Hall of Fame trainer. You had sort of a flamboyant, if not exactly reputable owner, and you had this terrific horse, and ultimately that's what it's about, is a terrific horse.
Joe, what's interesting to me is that there has to be a point within American Pharoah's journey where you're thinking to yourself, okay, if he wins, this is a really interesting book. So are you chronicling, let's say, starting at the Preakness? Like, are you starting to not only do the day-to-day stuff that you have to do for the New York Times, but start to report out what might be a book? Or does the process not start until after he wins Belmont? I'm curious just in the mental conception of when you thought this book could possibly exist.
You know, the process of really arcing it and writing it and digging into reporting it came after the Belmont. But the advantage I had, and there's a few of us, including your colleague Tim Layden, is we've been around this for so long. We know the rhythms of it. I mean, I've been talking to Bob Baffert for 20 years. Ziad, I've been talking, Ahmed Ziad, the owner, I've been talking to for 5 years, Victor Espinoza another 18, and you kind of figure out where the ups and downs are. I've been in the breeding shed. I have been at the sales. I've been out on the farms in Kentucky. So, you know, you had this deep base of knowledge, but really, until he won the Belmont, all that is just sort of, my dad used to call it useless information, you know, and I had the master of this useless information that I had accumulated, but now it had a place to come out and a forum to do it. And I kind of fell in love with the story after the Belmont, because then you go back, and I had told little bits of it when I was in stories in the paper, but you went out and you see how lucky this horse was. You know, I found Frances Relihan, a woman who ran the Vinery Farm down in Kentucky, and she saw something in him when he was 7 months old and saw him in a field, and she'd seen thousands of horses, and she knew something was special about this one. You know, the owner, Ahmed Zayat, was in money trouble. He tried to sell this horse a couple times. And, you know, there but the grace of God, it's somebody else's Triple Crown horse. Victor Espinoza was a guy who was the fifth choice. He had fallen out with Bob Baffert. If Gary Stevens doesn't go have his knee replaced, if Rafael Barrerano in on another horse, if Mike Smith's traveling out of town one weekend, he never gets on the horse. And then you find the two-year-old farm, the McCathens run, where Baffert and a lot of others break their horse. And you find this story about they knew he was the best thing that they'd ever had step foot on their farm in March of his two-year-old year, and were afraid to keep him there too long because they thought he was going to get hurt. And there's a great YouTube video of his first really workout in a showcase. And you see and hear everybody go quiet as you watch this great creature start going through his paces. So, you know, then, you know, that's a long way to answer your question, is the arc and the story fell in place after he won the Belmont. I mean, you, I, we're daily journalists. We got a lot of stuff we got to do to, you know, do our day jobs, right?
Absolutely. The Joe, how long did it take to... How long did it take to write the book, the actual physical process of writing?
It probably took about 8 weeks. And, you know, I'm always hesitant to say that because then you think, all right, yeah, it's quick. But, you know, I've done three books. My last three books have been same sort of template following a season. You know, I went down to high school in Kansas, and they won the championship in their 69th game in a row in November, and I had to deliver in March. Same with West Point on that. And I think anybody who's done these, and you know a lot of people who've done these, everybody has a different way to work. And, you know, I'm not proud of it, but I think an awful lot about it, and I get all balled up and procrastinating. And then, you know, you say, I got to be done in 8 weeks, so the rubber hits the road, and you kind of unloose, and you just kind of pour it out. And what I've discovered, this is my seventh, is that, you know, the instincts are there, and that if you just let it go, it's easier to have it on page and revise it than it is to go from zero blank pages to 300.
Joe, a book about a horse or a book on horse racing to me always seems to be a tricky proposition. If you obviously hit it out of the park like Seabiscuit, you know, it can make millions of dollars. But it seems to me that it must have been, it's a little bit of a sell to publishing houses, because this is not the NFL and it's not college football. Did you have to make any kind of let me rephrase that. Was getting this book sold tough, or because it was a Triple Crown winner, it's a unique situation and people would be interested?
It was a unique situation for a couple reasons. One, I had already had a deal for something down the road with Hachette Books. And when this happened, they said, how about a two? Let's do this. You have a Triple Crown, first time in 37 years. You also, I'm in New York, the publishing capital. I've done this a long time. People recognize me. I've written two previous books about horse racing, one about the last black jockey to win the Derby, one sort of a memoir of my year in. So, you know, I was a known quantity. And then I just put together a quick email memo, and I'm with you. Horse books are, there's far more misses than hits. But the hits come when you focus on the horse. You really had to approach it as this is an autobiography of a horse, as a biography, because he can't talk to me, right?
Right.
And you have to, Seabiscuit worked because you fell in love with the horse and the people around him were incredibly interesting, and it told you about a time and place. You know, Secretariat the same way. Secretariat was sort of a tale of the old world golden era of horse racing and this woman navigating her way in it as an outsider. And, you know, what you had here with American Pharoah is this thirst in sports, not just in horse racing, to have a Triple Crown champion because it had been so long. And it is such a preternatural sort of achievement. It's like a grand slam in golf or in tennis. I mean, there's some things that, you know, I don't really care about tennis, but a grand slam would move me. So you had that thing going, and you just had to build it from there. Now, is this going to be Seabiscuit? Probably not. But I think a lot of people are very interested in it because it is fresh and it is magical.
Joe Mo, I'm interested in how you put together the opening chapter of the book. I think it's the opening chapter, where you take the reader into the breeding shed with little Princess Emma and Pioneer of the Nile. That's, for, in layman's terms, basically the parents of American Pharoah. And it was pretty fascinating because your description of what happened is incredibly detailed. And I don't think most people have ever been in a breeding shed to see how that conception is made. So what was the reporting that went into that? I think you might even have written this. Was that videotape, so you were able to sort of go back and really pinpoint the details, or take me into the process of reporting that particular chapter and that particular scene?
I had been in several breeding sheds over the years and had written at least one story, and I believe it was about Elusive Quality. And so I knew that that was a great story to tell right there. And it's, you know, you got to start at the beginning that this is, it shows how far-fetched it is to go from this 15-second mating of two horses who neither one of them were incredibly accomplished to 4 years later, you have a Triple Crown champion and a horse that people have fallen for. So, you know, I knew I needed to do that. And then I just went and called and did the reporting. I've looked in there. I've been in breeding sheds. I know how they're built and they're configured. I looked at pictures. I know they're videotaped. So I just kind of put myself in the place, took my base of knowledge, talked to the people who were there. You know, Francis Relihan was just incredibly helpful in all the Kentucky horse raising and breeding part of it. And, you know, I thought people would be interested in it because it is something we take for granted. You know, horses in the wild do it all the time. Thoroughbreds, there's this weird rule, like you have to do it the old-fashioned way. Other sports you can artificially inseminate. And these are million-dollar animals doing a 15-second act where four people sort of choreographing it, guiding the, you know, I don't know how graphic I want to get on your podcast, but somebody's got to make sure it goes in. Somebody needs a semen sample for insurance purposes, so somebody's got to be underneath to get it. And it's got to be videotaped, so if something gets hurt, they can make claims on it. So it's a really fascinating, it's a natural act that is worth millions of dollars and has been commodified to that deal. And, you know, you kind of look, where is anybody from? If you did a human biography, you'd say, who's their father? How'd they grow up? Well, these are horses. But you had sort of a decent stallion who came in second in the 2009 Derby, who was making nothing. They couldn't even fill the book, and the book is how many times you do it each spring in the mating season. 150 to 200 is great. He was only doing 80. He was only doing it for $15,000. They just came and announced his stud fee is now $150,000 for what he's doing right now. And you had this mare who was well made, who ran two races and never won any of them. And so, you know, there's a whole saying in breeding that you breed the best of the best and hope for the best.
Right.
And in this one, this was just, you know, it's more luck than science. It's more art. It's more feel. I've always been fascinated by that end of the business, so I guess that's why I started there.
How would you rate the access that was provided for you for this book from both Bob Baffert and Ahmed Zayat?
Very good, very good. And I acknowledge at the end of it. I mean, over the years, we've butted heads with both of them. I mean, we've had to have difficult conversations. The news is the news. They've had some incidents that I'm sure they would have rather not had reported, but it's what we do. I've always made it clear to them that none of this is personal. I'm from the old school that when you write something hard, you show up the next day and let them yell at you and tell you what they think and give them a chance to object to any characterizations. So I think that served me over the years. And, you know, it was such a public campaign. Once you got to the Triple Crown, there was many of us pouring over this story. And you go look at the transcripts from their teleconferences or their post-game things. A lot of this tumbles out. I mean, a lot of it is right there in front of you.
Joe, in terms of this book, is there, and now you've done a couple of them, but unique to this book, was there anything that you learned from the process of reporting and writing this book that you would specifically use again for your next book?
Well, my next book is the furthest thing in the world. It's about how you become a saint in the Catholic Church.
Wow. And talk about a segue. Yeah.
You learn on all these books, and what you learn are the same things like when I go to journalism schools. The first thing you do is you listen, and you take your time with people, because people always have a story to tell, and they want to talk. So if you get in front of them or you find something that, you know, I missed during the campaign, but I see a story in the Lexington, I was like, this is interesting. Let's call back and ask about this. You know, it's all in the reporting. What at least I'll speak for myself, and I'm not any great author of, you know, I'm not John McPhee, okay? But I've done this enough, and I've gotten better each one. And what you end up learning is trusting your instincts and your storytelling, and you let the story go with it. So it's always, they could be different things. It could be a high school football team in Kansas. It could be a horse in the Triple Crown. It could be the lawyer who's going to argue Archbishop Sheen's case for the Vatican for sainthood. But they're all stories, and you kind of got to get people interested. You got to start with something that grabs them. You got to have conflict and an arc. You got to develop characters all the way through. So, yeah, you learn everything all over again, and that's really the fun of writing books. I mean, I'm a newspaper guy. You're a magazine guy. We have short muscles where we crank it out, deadlines. We get the media muscles, enterprise things. We do long investigative stuff. But there are some things that you just want to take your time and tell slowly and tell, like, you know, a storyteller around a campfire or like you're watching a movie. And so that's what books allow me to do.
Joe, what 25 years from now, how do you think American Pharoah will be looked at in relation to the horses that have stood the test of time, Affirmed, Seattle Sloop, Secretariat, Citation, et cetera? Does American Pharoah get remembered within that class, or is he in a different place?
He absolutely belongs. I mean, nobody's going to say he got lucky. He was an impressive, impressive racehorse. Lost once. They made some adjustments. It was his first time. He fought back in the Derby to win. He won by daylight. He did, his loss in the Travers was gallant because he held off a horse and then almost held off another one. He was the real deal. And, you know, look, there's only 12 now in almost 200 years of this. How he's going to be looked at 25 years kind of depends on how many more we get of these between now and 25 years. You know, history says, or the patterns, the sequences. I have an 11-year-old, and if you go to their math classes, they talk about sequences. there's 25 years between citation and secretariat, then you had three roughly in a row. You had secretariat in 73, SLU in 77, and affirmed in 78. So the odds say maybe we're going to get a couple more in a short period of time. But then that opens the whole question up. There, it's a different breed. There's not as many horses around. It's harder to do. You know, when Secretariat and those horses ran, it was still sort of a pastime, a sport of kings, where families bred to race. Now you have people owning pieces of them, and as soon as they win a big race, at two or three, they sell them to get them in the stallion sheds to make money that way. So, you know, there's a lot more variables now than there was then, and they face bigger fields in these Triple Crown races. So American Pharoah belongs, and nobody will tell you differently than that. He did it, and he did it very impressively.
All right, let's finish up on this topic, Joe, and that is, as you're looking forward to storylines in 2016, for you, is the number one storyline at the moment Nyquist? It's the horse's 7-for-7, two-year-old champ, never been beaten, and won the Florida Derby. I happen to read the piece that recently that just came out. I think every week you guys do in the Times a kind of a Derby dartboard, and it seems right. Like the big question is, you know, whether the horse is bred for a mile and a quarter. But at the moment, if you're a horse racing fan, you have to be optimistic because you have a horse coming into the Derby that really seems to be a star.
He's no doubt. It's him. He's head and shoulders above everybody else. All the reasons you said, undefeated, two-year-old champ, has won for fun. And then you kind of look behind him. And right now I have the Japanese horse, and I'm in the office today. My horse playing friends come and gig me about it. It was like, how can you pick the Japanese horse who nobody's ever seen, won the UAE Derby? And I said, well, I've seen everybody else, and nobody's close to Nyquist at this point. Doesn't mean in 5 weeks they might be, but right now he just lays over the field. So that's the number one storyline. On the human connections, it's the same owner-trainer that had I'll Have Another, who got two-thirds of the Triple Crown back in 2012 and then had to scratch the night before the Belmont. Mm-hmm. That's compelling. And again, horse racing is sort of this colorful, gritty sort of chicanery, a lot of chicanery kind of circles around it. The owner is J. Paul Redham. He had a mortgage company that Governor Jerry Brown called was loan sharking, payday loan kind of places. You got Doug O'Neill, the trainer. He's got the most drug violations of anybody going right now, and that became a storyline in 2012. And, you know, he's a gregarious, very quotable guy, but this cloud scent is always around him. So you have that. And then the other storyline that is people are going to be very interested in is, do you want another Triple Crown? American Pharoah did it. Do we want two in a row?
Right.
Is it realistic to hope for two in a row? Are people rooting for or against it happening? So, you know, those are the two big stories right now until somebody kind of pops up and go. You know, as a handicapper, as a horse player, I got a feeling this is going to be a year where somebody from the clouds is going to come. You know, Giacomo at 50-1, Animal Kingdom at 25-1. And it's no knock on Nyquist. It's just so many can go wrong in a 20 horse field, and you got to have the right posts. You got to be perfect on the way up to the race. The Derby, you got to win the Derby first to get the Triple Crown, and more horses that win the Derby are not Triple Crown material than there are ones that can win the next two.
The Japanese,
does that make sense?
It does. The Japanese horse is pronounced Lanny.
It's pronounced Lanny, and Lanny was bred in Kentucky, and his great-grandsire is Sunday Silence, who came a Belmont away from sweeping the Triple Crown in 1989 and is the leading stallion in Japan. Japan has a very healthy, accomplished horse racing sport and industry. They've come over before. They know what they're doing. They won this race in Dubai, and they went straight to Louisville. He's down there training in Louisville right now for the Derby. And, you know, some of it is you got to be a wise guy and just kind of zig when everybody else is zagging, but I can at least talk myself into betting them.
All right, well, watch that. That's kind of an interesting, that's an interesting horse to watch. All right, baseball season's underway, and it's time to get into the game. If you drafted Trevor Story this year for whatever fantasy team you play, hats off to you, because that is one heck of a move. Did not see that monster year coming. This year, though, you can be more than just a fan. You can run your own team on FanDuel. It's the most fun you can have as a baseball fan. FanDuel isn't just for the stat experts. FanDuel is for every fan, from the casual player to the hardcore seamheads. You can set up a league with your friends or play to win cash from fans around the world. Entry fees start at just $1, and there's no season-long commitment. Play for one day or play for the rest of the season plus the playoffs. Here's the best part. FanDuel is giving new players their first game risk-free. Just go to FanDuel.com, enter the code SIMedia, then enter a FanDuel league or start one with your friends. If you don't win any prize in your first contest, you get that $10 right back to your FanDuel account for more play. That's FanDuel.com using my code SIMedia for a risk-free tournament at up to $10. All right, Joe, let's finish up on this. You know, one of the things that you do at the New York Times is that you've done a lot of investigative pieces on the care of horses and the breakdown of horses. New York in particular has had a significant history of horses breaking down at the track, the Aqueduct, Belmont, et cetera. So my final question for you is, how do you get the general public that doesn't go to the horse racing track, how do you get them interested in stories about the care of the animals that that we see on tracks and obviously that we fall in love with in Kentucky, but that we don't necessarily pay attention to during the rest of the year?
Well, what I discovered is I came at it backwards. What I discovered is people want to read those stories because they have such a deep connection to the animals. It's easier to tell them about some abuse or some things that are not exactly right because they're so terribly offended by it. And, you know, the examples I use is in 1999, Charismatic was in the stretch, almost ready to win the Triple Crown, broke his leg, finished third, survived. It was a one-day story. I wrote a sidebar and a follow-up the next day. By 2006, we're into the metric age with the internet and most emailed lists, and Barbaro breaks down early in the Preakness, and every story I write from there goes to the top of the email list. There's people emailing me. They're sending cards down to New Bolton, to the hospital he was at, to the several months saga to try to save his life was riveting stuff. And that's when I discovered just how much horses mean to people. And it's sort of a very natural connection. It's America's oldest sport. And think about it, Richard, it's the character of America. My horse is faster than yours. Let's bet on it. I mean, all competition goes from there. It's the only horse or the only sport that originated out of the White House. Andrew Jackson ran a stable when he was president in there. People love these animals, and people are very aware to treating them humanely, to seeing their magic, to seeing how they take flight, and they want them well cared for. And what the industry was slow to recognize was you have two audiences. You have the 30 million people, tourists I'll call them, or just they drop in Triple Crown and they want to see the big hats, the mint juleps, 150,000 people watching these horses go around the Derby or Churchill Downs in the Derby. And then they want to see if he or she will follow on and win the Triple Crown. But then you have 2 million people who are the lifeblood of the business. They bet $11 billion a year, year round, at tracks like Aqueduct here in New York or Penn National or Lone Star Park. And they want a level playing field. So when they hear and find out and know that they're doping horses up and running sore ones, and they're sending them to the kill pens when their careers used up. They're outraged, and they want changes too. So those are the stories, you know, unfortunately, that get people, easy to get people to read. And, you know, to the credit of the sport, since these stories started popping in 2012, they have tried to reform, and there have been meaningful changes and rules and regulations and penalties put in. But it's still part of the game.
Joe Drape is an award-winning sports writer for the New York Times. He specializes in horse racing and investigations. He has a new book out later this month titled American Pharaoh, The Untold Story of the Triple Crown Winner's Legendary Rise. I have an advanced copy of it. I really, really enjoyed it. It's obviously, if you're a horse racing fan, you should check it out. But it goes beyond horse racing, just given how American Pharaoh connected with the sports culture at large. Joe Drape, thank you very much for being part of the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast, and best of luck with the book.
Richard, thanks for having me, and I do enjoy listening, and I enjoy your media column. It kind of curates all the stuff I missed over the week.
I appreciate the clicks, Joe. Thank you very much. Thanks again.
All right.
All right, back in studio. My thanks to Jeff Passan and Joe Drape. Check out their books. Both really good journalists, excellent writers and reporters, and not surprisingly, delivered on their books. I'll bring in Bette Marston right now. Bette, a little different podcast for us, just sort of going the NPR author route as opposed to a straight guest talking about their profession.
Yeah, definitely different, but different can be good sometimes. I enjoyed both of those guys, and I really think that horse racing, I can't wait to read that book. Horse racing is something that has such, first of all, it has a very niche but big following, and there's so much to it that you don't necessarily see on TV that's part of the Triple Crown. I mean, all of this breeding, there's so much that goes inside of it, and the insurances, and when you bring two horses together and the owners are there and everyone's there to make sure that there's no foul play. And you know, it's almost like I want to read more about foul play that's gone on in the past in order to create these types of measures. But yeah, I think that's all very fascinating.
Yeah, I'll give you the book, Beth, but the first part of the book about how American Pharaoh sort of came to be in the breeding mm-hmm. shed is just really interesting.
Oh, like absolutely.
You just have no idea, like, that world exists, but
yeah.
They
definitely don't show that on TV during the Kentucky Derby.
No, but it's a multi-million dollar world, and it's
absolutely.
Like really interesting.
And it's just it's just such a small group of people that it's not publicized at all. So
right.
I think that's probably for reasons. Good reasons, yeah.
Exactly. All right, so thanks to Joe Drape and Jeff Passan. Previous podcasts, if you want to check them out, include Hubie Brown, Kara Lawson, Renee Young, Ken Burns, and we got some good guests coming up for you as well. Okay, you can follow me on Twitter at Richard Deitch, follow Bette Marston at Bette Marston. You can subscribe to the show in iTunes, Stitcher, or your podcast app of choice. My thanks to Dan Bloom, Ryan Hunt, Paul Fichtenbaum, Chris Stone, John Wertheim. Who else am I missing? Ben Eagle, Bette Marston, Alan Kim, Dan Bloom, and a cast of thousands. For Bette Marston, this is Richard Deitch. We'll see you again on the Sports Illustrated Media Podcast.
Do you know about the Locked On Podcast Network? The number one daily sports podcast network. Locked On has a daily podcast on every NBA and NFL team, plus a growing lineup of college and MLB teams. You get a daily bite-sized podcast giving you the latest on your team from the local experts. Lakers fans, search Locked On Lakers. Cowboys fans, search Locked On Cowboys. Just search Locked On, your favorite team, on Apple Podcasts or Google Podcasts, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.